So that lays the groundwork for at least some sense of what how Westerners, as distinct from indigenous people, related to nature. But I wanted to be more specific now. There are at least five ways to describe human relationship with nature, or five ways to characterize humans as valuing nature or perhaps not valuing nature. And I wanted to go through those quickly. I started in my analysis of the colonial versus indigenous relationship to nature and the colonial indigenous to indigenous people, I started describing what we might call an instrumental view, that nature has an instrumental value to people, such that nature is something to be manipulated, controlled, conquered for the benefit of people. And as a, as another side note, it's important to note that even in as Westerners, our experience over the generations has changed, our experience with nature. Back again to these colonial times, an important thing to know and to remember is that before there was so much, how would you say, like development, settlements, conquering of nature, building of cities, modern technology, modern conveniences, modern dwellings, houses with modern appliances, protection from the elements. Before all of that happened over the last couple hundred years in North America, nature was something to be feared. The colonialists, probably more so than the indigenous people, really did fear for their safety. The extremes of weather, the lack of availability of food at times were an existential threat to their existence. Nowadays, we have the luxury of thinking of nature as recreational or a playground or something to be, to enjoy, to get away from the city and get back to nature. That's a modern, when I say modern, I mean in the last 100 years type activity or type value. So there's been a real flip, right? So when North America was mostly wild, there were animals, extreme weather, obstacles, the Lewis and Clark expedition that traveled from the east all the way to the west coast and wound up at the mouth of the Astoria River in Oregon. Some of them died. They encountered so many obstacles just traveling over mountain ranges and rivers and so on, and the elements and animals. They were huge dangers. So that's another important point to remember. It's not all cultural. Part of it is just the physical reality. So that's an important point. So the instrumental value of nature would include these considerations, these theories, the metaphysics of people like Hobbes and Huxley and other English theorists and colonialists. What are some other examples of instrumental value of nature? In other words, nature as it serves or doesn't serve or is to be managed or controlled by people such that it's on people's sides rather than against people. So some more contemporary examples might be parks. I mean, Huxley talked about gardens, right? So it's the same thing. A park is a harnessing of nature for the instrumental use of people. So rather than a patch of wildland with dangers and harshness, people create parks, right, with benches and camping spots and grass, comfortable for recreation, for hiking, hiking trails, for skiing, sporting events. So nature is reworked, crafted for the instrumental use value to people.
It's aestheticized in that way too. I mean, it's given a, there is this experience of going into a park or going to a mountain resort or something, and it's difficult to deny the kind of experience that one has when one goes there, but this is a very carefully framed aesthetic appreciation that we have.
Mm-hmm. Right. So you've touched on another value, which I'll get to in a minute, which is the aesthetic value, but it's also important to realize that all these overlap, these five ways that people relate to nature that I'm talking about actually do overlap with each other. And before I go on, I just want to say that we are listening, we are talking, and you're listening to the Canadian Philosophy Show. I'm Michael Robert Cadis. I'm with Brandon Brownlee. We're doing like a crash course in environmental ethics. So the instrumental value of nature, another example would be the value of waterways to transport goods, barges, ships, that kind of thing through waterways. And sometimes that nature has to be maintained in an unspoiled way. Pollution has to get kept to a minimum to make those waterways usable or to make farmland productive. There can't be too much depletion of the soils, right? So we know about the a lot of problems in parts of the world, including the Napa Valley in California, where there's been such intense grape growing that the soils have become calcified and depleted. So all these are instrumental considerations. Instrumental nature, it needs to be managed and properly maintained by people for people's instrumental use to be beneficial to people. So I'll go on to the aesthetic, as you touched on that already. So that's the second category, the second way that nature might be considered valuable. And it's also another way that it's valuable to people. So it does really overlap with the instrumental, as you were pointing out, Brandon. Think about if you have a lot of money, you can afford to live up on a hill with great ocean views. Nature might be valuable because it's beautiful. Maybe you want to live in a quiet place rather than a noisy place. You'd rather hear the wind blowing in the pine trees rather than hear a busy highway next to you. That's aesthetics, right? Want to be able to relax rather than be in a congested, stressful environment, but nature is so relaxing. You want to live by across the street from a forest rather than across the street from a construction site or something. So nature has an aesthetic value. That's pretty self-evident, the aesthetic value of nature. It does, again, in a sense, it's instrumental also because the aesthetics of nature are as experienced by humans. And then another area would be the economic value of nature. Again, though, it's under the umbrella of instrumental because nature is or can be economically important to humans. I'm thinking of examples like tourism, you know, national parks, and we all know about. I was just reading a few days ago that Yosemite National Park in California has become so overrun with people that they're now requiring, starting this summer, they're going to require reservations to go in there with a car. They're way beyond camping reservations. You can't even drive into the park starting this spring, I think, without making a reservation online. You can't even drive in there. We're talking about economics. Well, think about logging. So a productive forest is economically important to foresters, to forestry companies, to logging companies, to those who make money, either working or selling forest products. Mining. Nature in the sense of minerals in the earth that can be extracted, that are economically feasible to extract, have economic importance. Fisheries and fishers and the fishing industry requires nature to be intact, at least to some degree, in order to be able to continue to produce revenue by either catching wild fish, by farming. So for all these economic interests, nature has a value. So that's three of the five. And they do overlap. And that what they have in common is that each of those three ways that nature is valued by people are, as evident, valuable because people assign value. Humans assign value to nature for these reasons. Instrumental in general, more specifically economic and aesthetic. But there's two more ways that I wanted to describe that nature is valuable or can be considered valuable from a philosophical or an ethical point of view. The next one I want to talk about is a little more hard to classify. I guess it really is instrumental also, but it's a little more, it also contains within it some non-instrumental value, but what it is, it's the transformative value of nature. So what that means is many people experience a transformation when they're out in nature, especially in a wild place, but could even be in a garden or in a park. I know I did personally, and many people do. Being in nature, spending time in nature, and experiencing through the senses the animals, the sounds, the smells, the views. There's something about being in a natural place, especially a wild place, that can transform a person. So it's a little more difficult to pin down, but there's actually been data which supports this. I remember there's been some studies which show that a walk in a forest can actually lower people's blood pressure and can fight depression and give people more positive attitudes. Being in a green place, being in the forest. But I know for me personally, when I was young, we went camping a lot. And then when I got old enough, I went backpacking. I put on a backpack and went with friends or with family for a few days in the wilderness. And it really did change me. It transformed me and changed my worldview, that connection with nature, that experience of being out in nature. So how is this ethically relevant? It's because by preserving nature, preserving wild places, it gives an opportunity of transformation to those that have the ability or choose or have the wherewithal to go spend some time in a natural place. So the philosophical content in the transformative value of nature, the ethical content, is that there is an ethical claim that to deny people the possibility of personal transformation, of finding meaning in their life. There's even an existentialist component to this, is that many people may find meaning in life, that their experience in the wilds or in nature may inform their worldviews, their experience with life. And so that it would be unethical is the claim from an ethical point of view. It would be unethical to destroy nature to the point that people would be denied that opportunity. So there's an ethical argument surrounding that. It would be an injustice. It would be to deny people freedom, the freedom to have the possibility of transformation, if not complete transformation, at least to have their lives informed by the experience that one could have in a natural place as opposed to in a concrete jungle. So that's the transformative value of nature for many people and the ethical imperative to provide that opportunity, the possibility of transformation by the preservation of nature. So those are four of the ways, and really the common thread that runs through all four of those is it has something to do with humans, the ways humans can benefit or have rights or find value in nature. And that leaves out one big argument from an ethical point of view about the value of nature. And this is the one that does not entail value to humans. And this is the intrinsic value of nature. So the assertion is, from a philosophical point of view, from an ethical point of view, that nature has an intrinsic value which is not observer relative. So that's another way to put, frame all this. So is the four ways so far before intrinsic that I've talked about nature as having value is in some sense observer relative. Intrinsic value of nature by definition is observer independent. So what's the justification for arguing that there's such a thing? Well, one of the justifications is to point out that over the decades and millennia, there's been cultural evolution in human culture such that there's been an expanding circle of moral concern. You don't have to go back that far in European history or North American history, same thing, right? To see that women didn't have rights or that black people didn't have rights. Just to, you know, go back a couple hundred years and black people, you know, were slaves in North America. A lot of them were slaves. They didn't have full human rights. Imperfectly, we would like to believe that now at least there's been some improvement, and to some extent, women are considered full-fledged human beings. People of color are considered full-fledged human beings. They've now fallen within the circle of moral concern and of intrinsic moral rights. So we would say that, many of us would say, that all human beings, regardless of gender, gender identity, regardless of color of skin, are intrinsically valuable. So there's been a cultural evolution, a political evolution, a social evolution over the last few hundred years in Western culture, such that more and more living beings and also animals, right, including animals, are now thought by many to have intrinsic value. It's the next logical step in this progression to argue that all of nature, even non-animals, that natural ecosystems, which include living in and unliving things, should also be considered to have intrinsic value. Why should we draw the line at human beings? Well, because originally we drew the line at male land. The United States was founded by male landowners. They were the ones that were considered to be intrinsically valuable. But why should we now draw the line where humans give way to other mammals and mammals give way to other types of living things? And then there's other elements of natural ecosystems that aren't even living, rocks and water. And where would we draw the line and why would we draw the line? Could it be the case that all of nature, that all of the earth, in fact, is intrinsically valuable? So that's the argument from an ethical point of view, that it would be arbitrary and without justification to draw a line someplace and say on one side of this line are intrinsically valuable things, on the other side are non-intrinsically valuable, only instrumentally valuable things. So the argument would be that it could be that everything on earth is intrinsically valuable.
So you say that intrinsic value is observer independent, and yet over time, we have expanded our, I like this term, this circle of moral concern. So you can see why I'm kind of trying to tease this out, that things are being increasingly considered, whereas consideration is observer dependent. So I think I see what the aspiration is. We need to cast the net as wide as we can because we are observer dependent. Like we are relative. We have our own, you know, we only have the moral perspective that we have. And so we should be casting the net as wide as we can so we capture as much value as we can. I mean, there might be things that still evade that. And that's just going to be, you know, when the next rich ontology comes along, then we're going to see what we neglected in that. Like something's not squaring right in my mind about considering things to be intrinsically valuable.
I understand your objection. And let me be Socratic about it and see if I can, if I can acknowledge and in fact even argue the point of view that you're taking, Brandon. So I get the potential contradiction here. There seems to be an internal contradiction between, on one hand, arguing that nature would have intrinsic value, but then saying that the reason that that's a justifiable claim is because humans have increasingly recognized the intrinsic value of women, of colored people, of animals, and now maybe of all of nature. The contradiction being, of course, that in the first part of the sentence, I'm claiming intrinsic value. In the second part, I'm saying, well, people are suggesting that people are the ones that have assigned it. But is that the contradiction or the paradox that you're referring to?
I think so, yeah.
Yeah. That's very interesting, I mean,
It might, because the thing that this comes down to might just be recognition of a thing that really was there.
Right.
We recognize that nature always had value, but what we considered in the past to be intrinsic was not intrinsic. And that's why I'm suggesting maybe it comes down to, you know, our circle of moral concern might expand again when we get a richer ontology and we recognize that there are even greater systems and beings to give moral recognition when we, you know, when we cross that threshold and find out, oh no, there was a lot more going, you know, there are more beings here than we thought. But we just didn't even see them, or we didn't think of them or something like that.
Right. So now you're touching on the response, right? The rejoinder to the objection, which is that the claim is not that people of color or women or people of different sexual orientations had no intrinsic value until society decided they did. That's not the claim. It's, as you suggested, it took some time for society to discover the intrinsic value. The intrinsic value wasn't created, didn't begin with a widening of the circle of moral concern. So circle of moral concern doesn't suggest that those entities outside of the circle don't have intrinsic value until the circle widens. That's not the claim. The claim is that they always did. And the circle widening just means that it's finally recognized. So with respect to nature, an ethical argument would go like that, right? So just as other living beings at one time weren't recognized as having intrinsic value, when they did, in fact, it may be the case now that all of nature, that ecosystems, that the whole earth, maybe the whole universe, has intrinsic value, and we're starting to discover that, and we should be discovering that from an ethical standpoint. To the extent one subscribes to this view, this ethical view that nature has intrinsic value, which is not observer dependent, then that can be associated with justification for preservation of wilderness, even when there's no, even if there were no instrumental value to people. And this is very controversial, obviously. It's very controversial, and it's only a fairly recent concept. This idea of wilderness preservation has gotten much traction. And there is a distinction and a rift between the old idea of conservation of natural resources, which is primarily a instrumental view of nature, forest management, responsible forest management, so the forest will be productive. Instrumental, that's not intrinsic value of the forest. It's an instrumental value of the forest. But the idea that areas would be set aside as wilderness areas, even at the expense of instrumental value, even if it means the lumber can't be harvested, even if it means that many people or very few people would be able to go there and enjoy it. You know, there are wilderness areas that it's a legal status in the United States, a wilderness area. And there's a lot of constraints in wilderness areas. You can't go there in a motor vehicle. There's other constraints. A lot of the areas you need a permit to get in there, and relatively few people have the ability to do it. You know, you have to be physically fit and have the ability to hike there or through that area. You can't take motor vehicles. One of the justifications for setting aside the wilderness area is the intrinsic value of nature and the intrinsic value of preserving wilderness for the sake of preserving wilderness. You have been listening to the Canadian Philosophy Show. Thank you very much, Brandon Brownlee, and my name is Michael Kaditz. Please email us at hello@philosophyshow.ca. You can find the Canadian Philosophy Show at tcps.podbean.com and on Apple Podcasts and Spotify.
Soca's first and second year social is happening soon. Join us at Soca, the Students of Caribbean and African Ancestry, in the Student Union Building, room 1430, on Friday, October 4th. From 5 p.m. onwards, this event is for the first and second years to meet and connect with new friends. All are welcome. See you there.
From natural disasters to unforeseen accidents, emergency preparedness is a crucial element of maintaining a safe school environment. Canada's diverse geography means schools can be vulnerable to a range of natural hazards, including severe weather, flooding, wildfires, and earthquakes. National School Safety Week is October 17 to 23, and the Canada Safety Council urges schools and communities to focus on strengthening emergency preparedness protocols. Find out more at CanadaSafetyCouncil.org.